you. I'd like to inform all participants that today's call is being recorded. If there's any objections, you may disconnect. You may go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much.
Well, you wouldn't mind if I hung up, would you?
What's that?
You wouldn't mind if I hung up?
Yes, I would. I know you. I know this. You'll enjoy this as much as we do because you like good dialogue. But I want to start off just by especially welcoming Rita to this session. And there's certainly no need to be disappointed by the limited participation. Quite a few people had conflicts, but the participation and the discussion and submittal of advanced questions, I think, was very good. And I suspect a lot of people are going to be listening to the recording as soon as they can. I want to thank all of you who submitted questions, as well as each of you that is participating on the call. The first thing I want us to do is just very briefly have Gwen remind us of the voting process that's going to happen here, I think, starting tomorrow.
Yes, I will do that, Chuck. Can you hear me?
I can.
The voting starts tomorrow, Friday, at 15 hours UTC, and it will end the following Friday on the 7th of March at 15 hours UTC. As we all know, there is only one candidate, Rita. The voting will be by secret ballot, and the same procedure that was used for the GNSO chair will be used in this vote. Please check your spam filters and return the ballot as soon as possible. That does speed up the process. All council members are eligible to vote, but not liaisons. There are 27 votes in all, and the majority of all council votes should be attained, that is 14 or more. In exceptional cases, you may vote by phone if you would be on holiday or not have internet connectivity or whatever. There will be a separate mailing list to manage the elections going forward. This is usually the procedure for for the board director votes. Now, anything to do with the elections should be on this list, and you will all have notification that you are subscribed to the list, that is the council members and the liaisons, myself and not the staff. And the messages are treated on this list as confidential until the end of the elections, but may be disclosed to General Counsel in order to obtain advice about how to handle procedural problems that might arise. The council list should be kept open for policy development work. The results of the election will be announced, as they usually are. That is, you will find your secret code, your confidential code, with the way that you voted, and each council member should check that the vote has been correctly recorded. The results of the vote will be confirmed at the council meeting on the 27th of March. And then, pursuant to the bylaws, the council should give notice of its selection to the general council no later than April the 2nd. So we will be in good time.
Any questions?
Yes.
Thanks, Gwen.
Thank you, Chuck.
Very helpful. Very quickly, I want to outline the process we're going to use this morning. You probably looked at that, but I'll go through it very quickly. First of all, I jotted down three purposes of the interview. Obviously, we want to interact with Rita regarding her current and future role on the board in preparation for our vote. But I think it's equally important that we want to allow counselors to not only learn about how Rita functions in the role of director, but also to understand her responsibilities in that role according to the ICAM bylaws. So we'll kind of start out a little bit on that direction. And then also we want to allow Rita to better understand our concerns and issues related to policy development processes, and including the roles of the board's role in that regard. I will give Lita an opportunity to make some introductory comments when we get started. And as far as procedures and guidelines, I'm going to coordinate the process, and we'll manage the queue from my side. If anybody finds out I'm not doing that correctly, please speak up. Okay. The questions submitted in advance are going to be asked first in the order listed as I sent out, unless for some reason we decide differently. Then I'll give Rita an opportunity to respond. Rita, you're welcome to ask clarifying questions. And then follow-up questions by anyone on the call will be allowed, including Rita. You can ask follow-up questions or make follow-up comments as well. The only thing I ask there is that stay on topic. There will be a general opportunity for new questions later on. So any new follow-up questions you have, though, on the same topic are welcome and encouraged. The person who submitted the question will be allowed to ask it if he or she is present. In other cases, I'll read their questions. Keep in mind that this is not a time to do policy development work, nor a time to advocate personal or constituency positions regarding policy issues. Because there is only one candidate, I think this should be viewed more as a two-way learning session for Rita and the council than a political debate. Hopefully the discussion will help us all improve in our ability to work together constructively to develop policy going forward. Now, any questions that were not submitted in advance may be asked during the discussion as long as they stay on topic. There will be opportunity after we discuss all the advanced questions for questions on new topics. So please hold those to the end unless they're related to something we're talking about. In the case of advanced questions, the name of the person who asked the question, you note I listed the name right at the beginning of the question in the document I sent out. And I think in all but one case, the advanced questions are printed with no substantive changes. And in that particular case, I put the original text there so that you could see that. Unfortunately, that person's on this call, so that'll make that one easy. Any questions or comments on the process? Okay, then let's get started. And Rita, I'll turn it over to you for any introductory things you'd like to say or ask.
Thanks, Chuck, and thanks everyone for giving me an opportunity to chat with you all on this call today. I've had some individual discussions with the registry and registrar constituencies and the BC. So it's good to kind of bring that all together now and have a call with all you folks in sort of the general council level. I think the one thing I'd like to say in terms of what I'd like to do going forward is really appreciate and improve the communication that both Bruce and I have with the council in a little bit more of a formal way, perhaps. Coming back last year, back into the ICANN community, it was an interesting re-indoctrination to see what issues had progressed and, frankly, what issues hadn't. And I think it's important sometimes when people engage in discussions and there's different ideas and different things that flow around, as Chuck said, sometimes the topic can get a little bit lost. So I'd really like us to think about ways that we can continue to improve the communication between you all and your GNSO reps. And as Bruce mentioned, I'll talk a little bit about my views on the fiduciary obligations that board members have. But one of the things that we did very recently was Chuck Aubrey and I would have some calls, and then once Bruce joined the board, the four of us would have some conversations so that Bruce and I really understood the position of the council and how we could understand that and help clarify that in board discussions. And I personally thought that was really helpful because it's a little bit difficult sometimes to glean just from the council meetings and some staff briefings really what the council's thinking and what some of the touch points are. So I'm looking forward to continuing that and also thinking through with some of you all ways to help improve that communication. We have the CNSO improvements proposal out there, and I really think that those of us on the board hope we're going to see kind of GNSO version 2.0, and the extent to which you all have helpful suggestions about how that can be executed, I'd love to hear them.
Thank you. Much appreciated, Rita. So let's get right into the questions. The first one I picked was kind of a health update question for Rita. For those that don't know, she stayed very active throughout this long recovery process she's been in, and even in the deli meeting as much as was possible with the communication problems that we had there. But Adrian asks, he says, Rita, you have been ill and away from occasional phone calls and recent ICANN meetings. Do you expect this to continue?
I appreciate the question. I have been doing my best to stay on topic, and in some ways I think not working has allowed me to actually participate a little bit more, at least in some of the board committees and the like. But I'm really hopeful that I'm going to be at the board retreat in Riga in April, and if I can't come to Paris, this is going to be a real problem. But I do not intend to miss any more meetings if at all physically possible. I fractured my heels, both of my heels and my back, and I'm learning a lot about the calcaneus, which is the densest bone in the body, and apparently is very unlike knee replacement or hip replacement or just standard broken bone. So it's my recovery is going a lot slower than I would have liked, but hopefully on track for getting me up and around in a significant way in the next couple months.
Thank you. Any follow-up questions or comments? Okay. And based on some of the discussion on our council list that I saw, I threw in this next question myself. As a director, is it accurate to say that your first responsibility is a fiduciary responsibility to ICANN, the corporation? And what does that mean, and how does that translate into the concept of representing the GNSO?
I think that's a great question, and it's actually something that at our board retreat in Sofia last October, after I just joined the board, it was something that I asked John to talk about a little bit, because I was surprised that a lot of directors hadn't been briefed on that and kind of didn't understand their role as a director versus their role in a constituency or sort of just as an individual, frankly. So I don't want to opine on this. It's really John Jeffries. Bailiwick, but my understanding is that, in fact, once you're a director, you have a fiduciary responsibility to the organization as a whole. But I think that's always what I have tried to employ, irrespective of kind of the legal ramifications. As a board member, I think it's important to take a holistic view of all the issues that face the ICANN community. And the GNSO certainly has, you know, a myriad of different perspectives, issues and ideas. So I think it's important to understand all of those and try to incorporate all of those points of view when being a director and seeking really the best possible outcome for the corporation.
Now, Rita, how does that then translate into, as you could tell by some of the questions that were asked, there are some people that think you're actually there representing the GNSO, and I think there's some truth to that, but how does that all fit together with the fiduciary responsibility?
Well, I do think that as a GNSO rep, it's important to understand where the GNSO is coming from. I think that's a role that Bruce and I need to play, and to the extent to which we participate in conference calls, we get some insight, but I think it's understanding the issues that you all are facing and being able to answer questions or help clarify and or also help bring issues to the fore. I know even just with the fast track and the CCTLD IDN working group, you know, we had conversations about that, and it was helpful for me to hear directly from you all what some of your concerns were. I was able to talk that through with folks on the executive committee to understand what you all were looking for and how we could try to help and resolve some issues. So I look at it as not a sort of, I'll say, all GNSO all the time advocate, but it is me understanding and Bruce understanding where you guys are coming from and trying to help the board engage in substantive discussions on some of these issues and try to make some progress.
Thank you. Any follow-up questions or comments that anyone would like to raise? Okay. Then I'll go to Avery's question, and I'll just read it. My question relates to the improvements casting the GNSO Council as a management body instead of a legislative body. One of the concerns that I wrote of in the public comment period has not really been alleviated by the last report. This concerns the distinction between policy management as an administrative function and policy management as a policy function. If I read the current proposal correctly, the council must pass on recommendations from working groups as long as they follow the to-be-developed process correctly, even if, in the consensus view of the council, the recommendation is really a bad idea. I think this relegates the GNSO Council to a purely administrative body and not a policy body. At the very least, I believe the council should be able to reject a policy recommendation if there is a supermajority against it. Same rules as apply to the board vis-a-vis a GNSO Council supermajority PDP decision. I would like to know your position regarding my concern. And before I let Rita respond to that, this is really a good question for Rita in a special sense, and that is that she's not only a board member, but she's on the Board Governance Committee, and she was on the Board Governance Committee working group that worked on the GNSO improvement recommendations. Rita, it's all yours.
Thanks, Chuck. So I looked through with the help of some of the working group members the language, because I thought that we'd put some language in the report, and we did, and I can certainly read that out. But I'm curious to know from you on the phone, again, I think one of the things that the working group was really hoping to achieve was to get this kind of idea of GNSO version 2.0. And this relates to, you know, everything from effective policy to, you know, Norbert's very good question about compensating council members. And I think that, you know, you all are super busy, you have day jobs, and what we at least were trying to respond to in this GNSO improvement working group was this notion of not having the kind of who is redux. In other words, people doing a lot of really hard work and not really being able to get to some sort of conclusion that everybody can agree to. I think the flip side to that was the new GCLD report, where I think people did a great job and did a lot of work in trying to come to some consensus. So I think if we looked at those two models and thought, you know, how do we try to hardwire, if you will, that type of more successful process within the GNSO improvement document. So the kind of parlance that we came up with was, let's move to sort of management as opposed to legislative, and this is really a choice of words to signal that we're trying to move away from kind of this weighted voting scenario. It wasn't meant to say that we're kind of quote-unquote relegating the council to be purely administrative. But one question that I have for you all is, if in fact we have this notion of a working group where the GNSO is actively involved in selecting and appointing chairs and vice chairs, and making sure that there is very robust representation within each working group to express the views of each of the constituencies, I'm not sure how we think we would then come to a recommendation to the working group that would be, quote unquote, a bad idea. Because that would be a bad result in my view. But I'm curious, again, if we take the premise that the GNSO is going to select a chair, there's going to be very strict kind of policies and process requirements to be followed in terms of everything from what the scope and the terms will be to, you know, what the specific issues are to how they will be discussed. If in fact then we have that coupled with robust constituency participation, how do we think we're going to get a bad recommendation that the council thinks is a bad idea?
Let me take a cue on that. Who would like to be in that queue?
John Bing.
John? Okay, who else?
Alan.
Alan, good. Anyone else? Okay, and you can jump in later if you just let me know. John, go ahead.
Yes. I don't really understand how this works compared to a delegation to the working group. I can see a working group being set up and launched into work and produce a result, which then is passed on. But from the experience of participating very modestly in working groups, the forcefulness with some put into especially telephone conferences, the differences in language skills, and so on, all may contribute to the balance in a working group to work rather differently from the balance in the council. So it depends really on whether you want to have a delegation to a working group or whether you want the working group to be a tool for the council to reach a consensus opinion. Thank you.
Rita, would you like to respond to that?
I think that's what we're trying to say. I think what John's saying is that it's different to say you guys just come up with a result to enable us to have a debate versus you come up with a result that we merely pass along. Is that right, John? That sounds like a fair distinction.
The part of the distinction is legal. That if you are bound to pass it on, you
right.
really have no authority and you have a delegation rather than
right.
a working group.
Right. So let me just read in what is in the report that I think will clarify this. And again, I'm getting this from the drafter of this language, but they're saying that section 5.2, because I knew we had something in here. And it talks about when a working group completes its work, it's going to present its report and conclusions, including any minority views, to the council for review. The council's role is to ensure that the working group follow the appropriate procedures, and I'm paraphrasing here a little bit, and achieved its goal and acted consistently with its mandate, including with respect to outreach, inclusiveness, effectiveness, and efficiency. The council should also verify the level of agreement in the working group. And this is, I think, the important language. In forwarding the working group's report to the board, the council should indicate the extent to which it believes that the working group has fulfilled its mandate, and the council may forward a minority report of its own if appropriate.
Yes.
The council should not reopen the substance of the policy issues, which would undermine the rationale for and efficiency of the process. At the same time, the council will have the option of sending an issue back to the working group for reconsideration if a supermajority believes that the report omitted critical facts or did not accurately reflect the working group's deliberations. So again, I think there was not an intention of having the council merely be a conduit to look at a report and pass it on. But there also was this language which did not intend to have working groups work, have a chair that's going to be someone who's sophisticated and well-versed in the issues, have a, you know, just for sake of argument, 6-month process, and then kind of have the council start deliberating at square one. So those were sort of the two tensions that we were trying to deal with in this language.
Yeah.
Does that make sense, John?
Not completely, I'm afraid. I find that one of the risks of having a democratic process is, of course, that it takes time. But if there's disagreement in the organization, it has to work itself out. And if there is sufficiently strong disagreement between the council and the working group, there certainly is something that should concern your principle of a consensus.
I think that's why, John, again, from my perspective as a board member, what I don't want to have happen is very diligent and earnest people working and have their efforts be viewed as not counting. That's one of the criticisms that we've heard quite a lot. So if we're going to have an effective council, in my view, that can create policy from the bottom up, the ground up, that's going to be able to be reviewed by the board and executed, and I think that's what we all want is efficiency here. I think that we need to have robust discussion in the working group, and that's what we were trying to do here, is make sure the working group had outreach, had representatives from each constituency that discussed things in a very substantive way. And in the report, if there wasn't a quote-unquote consensus, that's specifically also why we including minority views.
Yeah, but the minority views.
What we think the council needs to see is what people thought and what the deliberation was. And what we're trying to do is push some of the deliberation to this working group to more effectively enable the council to have any debates as necessary.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, well, I won't prolong this more, but in my mind, it would make more sense if it only, if it had been the council passing the report on to the council with its own recommendation, so that there always was a recommendation from the council, which could be brief or long or whatever the council thought, and it could be in agreement or in opposition or making nuances with respect to the, that report. And that would be a normal procedure, in my, opinion. And it would, wouldn't delay things, but would make the council be clearly in control of the process.
Now, Rita, that doesn't, to me, sound too much different than what you said.
I would agree, Chuck.
Okay. So I think that we're on the same page there. Okay. Alan.
Yeah. Two things. First, to answer Rita's question of how would it be possible for a working group to come up with something that the council then disagrees with strongly. I think part of the answer to that, in my mind, is the description of how the working groups will be constituted, how they will work, how the chairman will be, the chair will be in strong control and make sure that the group is not shanghaied by particular interests. I think that's very idealistic. Some working groups and some chairs are excellent and manage to do it. Some are so far from it that it's hard to imagine that we're going to legislate that these are going to all work well. And I think that's part of the concern.
Okay.
How do we make sure that these working groups really meet the idealistic description that's in the report?
Now, I'll let Rita respond, yeah. But I want to say that it seems to me that a large part of that responsibility is going to be in our hands in the design of the working groups. Now, we're probably not going to be perfect, so, you know, to be so idealistic to think that we're going to get it perfect and won't have problem situations is naive, but at the same time, we will have the opportunity in the next few months to try and do everything we can based on our experience, and we've got a lot of good experience, both good and bad, design a process that will hopefully maximize the chances of success and minimize those chances of failure that you're talking about, Alan. Rita, you want to respond?
I appreciate that, Chuck, and that's exactly how I feel. You know, I think that if you strive for perfection in anything, you don't really get much more than inaction. And I think that it's very easy within the ICANN structures to prefer inaction. I think we've seen that. It's very easy for people in a working group to dig their heels in and never agree, and that's what some people put on their agenda, to be quite blunt. And if that's what people want to do, there's nothing that any working group, any revised bylaws, any kind of procedures can get around. So, I don't have any response to kind of people not acting in good faith. What I do think is that, as Chuck said, there's a situation where we're trying to constitute these working groups and have people come to them with the intention of trying to resolve issues, and that's really what the hope is.
And I think the recommendations did have some suggestions with regard to giving the chair some authority to manage recalcitrant people that may be involved so that it's not possible for just one or two people to hold up the show.
As I said, it's a theory, and it's a theory I support. The question is, how do you really make it happen, given that we're dealing with a wide range of people with different experiences and different intents?
Well, and again, I would sort of reemphasize what Chuck said, which is my response to this is, at some point, you know, the board cannot micromanage individuals, and I do think it's the genius or his obligation to really bring everyone in and say, look, we can either work here together, everyone, or not. And, you know, at some point, it is your all responsibility.
Thanks, Alan.
I've got a follow-up to
Robert's
original question. As you mentioned, there's the possibility, and probably the likely possibility in a lot of cases, of minority reports from working groups. It seems reasonably clear from the discussions I've had that the board doesn't really want to have to arbitrate between the minority reports, and that would put it on the council to try to resolve those. Do you see that as a council responsibility, or do you see minority reports from working groups being passed on to the board, essentially with or without comment, but being passed on?
I am an advocate of more information is better, and I guess most of you probably know, but I'm an attorney, and what I do is mostly deal work. I started out doing a lot of trademark work, but now I do mostly deals, and so it's both, you know, in a buy-sell context, but also joint ventures and a lot of licensing. And so what is involved in that oftentimes is coming to the table where two people want to get something done, but they're very far apart. And what I have to do is then listen to both sides and in many cases figure out, you know, how do we get beyond what seems an insurmountable impasse. And so I actually like having more information and having the difficult questions asked. You know, that's kind of my thing, is to try to help people come together when you don't think it's possible. So for me, and I can't speak for all board members on this, but from my perspective, if the council can come together and say, this minority is really sort of one recalcitrant person who's not really expressing the views of his or her constituency, you know, again, I'm not going to micromanage how the council wants to present its information to the board. That's your all bailiwick. But as a board member, I'd like to know what different positions are, because if there is, in fact, just to take an example, but if there's an issue that really would affect trademark owners, and every other constituency says X, but there's this quote-unquote minority, but if you look at the issue, it actually has a big impact on trademark owners. I want to know what their view is, even if there's only if it's a minority view. Conversely, if there's something that's really going to affect individual users, and everybody except the individual users have something to say, I want to know what the individual users have to say, because I think that's important in terms of the issue. So it's not a kind of cookie-cutter, one-size-fits-all here, but I, as a board member, think that more information, and when I say that, I mean more information that's actually real formal information in the form of these reports, is better than less.
Isn't it accurate to say that when just because a minority report is passed on to the board doesn't mean that we're asking the board to resolve that minority opinion?
I don't think it is, Chuck. I think it's more of an FYI. That's how I view it.
Now, it's a different situation if we give the board something that's got a simple majority support and there's a fairly significant difference of opinion on the simple majority recommendation. That's kind of a different situation, and for us to do that to the board, that raises maybe even more of the questions that you're asking, Alan.
And that was exactly the kind. I wasn't talking about the IPC has a strong view on our individual users, but if there's a real mixed report from the working group, I know talking to Roberto, he gave me the very clear impression that the board doesn't want it stuck in their lap to try to essentially revisit the whole issue and decide which way to go. And if not then council has a responsibility.
Right.
That's right. That is right. And again, you know, I've said it many times before, everybody wants bottom up except when they want top up to resolve some other issues. You know, so you kind of can't have it both ways. But yeah, the board doesn't want to be doing that and seeing as like imposing, here's what we're going to do and here's the better position.
Which means there are going to be times when council becomes the policy making or policy recommending body when the working group can't come to reasonable closure on.
I think that's right, and I think that's one of the things that will be helpful for you all to participate in this kind of implementation of this new GNSO improvement. I think that's very important because, again, you know, while the people on the working group for GNSO improvements certainly have a varying amount of experience with the GNSO and ICANN in general, we're not on the council, and so I think it's very important to have you all participate in these implementation as much as possible to give the kind of reality checklist, if you will.
Great. Thank you.
And this kind of issue where there's not a real strong majority on a recommendation is probably another illustration where the council's policy management role is more than what people suspect, because that's at the point where maybe we decide not to pass it on to the board, to go back to the working group, or to take some other methods to try and see if we can't come up with a position. And sometimes we might make a decision that there frankly is no consensus, so we just let market forces work if it's not an emergency situation or something like that. One other thought I wanted to throw into this, and before I do that, I want to welcome Rob Hogarth to the call. Welcome, Rob. I think also that when we're talking about the council managing the policy development process, I don't view it, and Rita, I'll let you respond to this to see if you think I'm on target. I don't see it, you know, you form a working group, you appoint a chair and maybe a vice chair, and you give them terms of reference, and they go off and do the work, and then you wait till they're done, and then the council gets involved. I see the council involved, not in a micromanagement role, but in an oversight role, probably by having one or two council members on the working group and regularly getting feedback so that if we see things that are happening that we think are contrary to what's supposed to be happening, we deal with those during the working group process, not after it's done. Is that a correct perception?
Is that for me, Chuck?
Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, as I said at the outset of this discussion, right, it's our intent that a lot of the working group will either be with counselors or with constituency reps that have views that their counselors share. If that's not the case, I think this whole model doesn't work.
Yeah.
May I ask a question then, Chuck?
Yes, John.
John, asking questions. Who do you find our authority to intervene after the working group has been launched?
I'm not sure. Run that by me again, John, please.
Yeah. Who do you find our authority to intervene? Let's say we disagree, and the working group said, all right, you disagree, but this is our view.
Well, I don't know if I'm grasping the full extent of your question, but if the... this is all premised on the fact that we've set up some fairly well-defined procedures for working groups.
Yeah.
And if we're observing some things that are going on in the working group, and that those procedures are going to be the basis for the council intervening to try and set things on the right track. Now, does that get at what you're asking?
Indeed. Thank you very much.
Okay. Good. Okay. Then let's go on to the next question. This one is from Adrian. How can we better progress outstanding issues, for example, domain tasting, transfers, GNSO reform, et cetera, with the board? Rita?
I think that one of the things that's really important, and I've used this word in a number of different agendas, is kind of priority. I think that oftentimes, you know, people head into an ICANN board meeting, and then there's certain issues that are meant to be addressed, and a lot of times other things start flying around, and people have discussions, and things come up, and sometimes we can get off topic. I do think that, I don't know how you all particularly prioritize on your agenda or have kind of a clear view of, you know, for calendar year 08, we're going to do X, and that's our priority, but I'm a big fan of priority and sort of a plan for execution. So I think it's important for the council to understand, you know, what are the issues that we really care about and what do we think needs to happen. Clearly at this juncture, you know, I am well aware, as is the board, that IDNs and new GTLDs are very important to people. And I think those are two huge issues that involve a lot of different viewpoints, a lot of different constituencies being involved. We have obviously CCs in the GAC, et cetera. So I think that those are two big things that I at least would like to see get some progress in the very short term. So I do think that, for example, if you look at the new GTLDs, one of the things that came out of the Delhi meeting was that staff is going to go back and talk to the GNSL about some issues that the board, I think, thought needed additional clarification or they had questions on. I think the extent to which the council can quickly address those, gel around those, come up with positions, and get back to staff quickly so that it can be passed on the board, I think that's all helpful. So again, from my perspective, I think it's about priority, communicating the priority, and trying to help execute on the priority.
Thank you. Any follow-up questions or comments on that? Okay. Going on to another question from Adrian. How can we better communicate through you to the board to get them to understand these issues and their importance?
I sort of saw that as kind of similar to the question before that, right? I think, it's having formal discussions so that Bruce and I can understand where you all are coming from. And the extent to which there's letters, I thought it was great, Chuck, the way you guys did a letter about the CC working group on IDNs. I think that's really helpful to that we had a discussion before that went out, so I understood what that was, and I could help communicate what that was to the board and help people understand where you guys were coming from. So,
again, and especially since it generated some controversy.
Yeah. But I think it's helpful for us to kind of understand where you're coming from, for Bruce and I to understand where you guys are coming from, so we can help aid in board discussions. So, again, it's about kind of regular communication.
Any follow-up questions or comments on that? Okay, going to question number 6, and Mike, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Chuck. Hey, Rita. Same question I asked you in our BC meeting the other day. Basically, in light of the discussion on the domain tasting working group list, how would you describe the registry constituency role in consensus policy development?
And as I said, I got to the BC, so I think this is probably coming out of some of the comments from New Delhi. I know that Jeff in the registry constituency is a little bit unhappy. He expressed to me his displeasure at how some of this domain tasting issues have been calculated. But this, I think, is a broader question of this notion of consensus policy and this, for those of you, I'm sure all of you have heard about this notion of the picket fence. And this is clearly an area where, as a board member, I don't think it's appropriate for me to say what is right and what is wrong. It's really a matter of general counsel. And I've had discussions with John Jeffrey on this issue of what does this kind of consensus picket fence mean. So John's sort of the person that needs to really definitively comment on this. But my understanding of consensus policies has always been that as a registry, you're, as Louis Tuton used to say to me, getting a piece of the public trust, and you're getting endowed with a monopoly to run a registry. And with that responsibility comes sort of some obligations. And the way that we look at some of those obligations is in consensus policies, which there's specific language in the registry contracts, and I think that they've been modified a little bit since I've looked at them last, but it's about this acknowledgement that there are certain areas that may be so important and so critical to the ICANN community that the registries should, in fact, follow them. One of those, you know, the kind of classic consensus policy is the UDRP. And so I think, again, that the registries are very important in terms of discussing consensus policies because the registries are running a business. And without their ability to run their business, they're not going to be incented to, you know, continue to participate. But there is then a balance with that of the notion that there are certain policies that the community may see, and a broad cross-section of the community may see as very vital to protecting the interests of the community. And so those policies are meant to be informed and adhered to by the registry.
Mike, do you have a follow-up on that?
No, thanks.
Anyone else? Mike and I have had quite a bit of dialogue via email on this. I would like to share some things I shared with him that I don't think it were shared on the broader list. But contrary to what some people's assumptions and maybe Jeff even implied it in some of his communications on the list, on the domain tasting list, I'm not aware of the registry constituency position taking a position on this particular issue of the registry's involvement in consensus policy development. The way I read it in the common net agreements is that, you know, there's language there that says the registries need to be involved in the consensus development process, and that's my own personal reading of that.
Hello.
And so I you know, again, I don't think there's a registry constituency position on the particular issue that's been debated on the DT list recently. So I just wanted to point that out. And so whether there will be or whether we could even reach a position, I don't know. And it really, like Rita said, these kind of things are really general counsel type issues in terms of how they apply. And I know, Mike, you're aware of that, and I think I'd address that. Anything else on that one? Thanks, Mike. Robin, you're up next on question number 7.
Great. Okay, my question has to do with freedom of expression and new top-level domains. Rita, in your view, should ICANN institute a one-size-fits-all policy prohibiting domain names that are considered immoral or contrary to public order in any part of the world? How should ICANN take into account the different legal and social systems at the local level to develop a global policy for introducing new top-level domains?
Rob, I have to tell you, this is my favorite question. I really think it's great, and it's frankly, those of you who know me a little bit know that I like to talk substance a lot more than process, and in some ways, this is one of the things that I really would like to have a robust discussion at the board level on. But I had a discussion with John Jeffrey during the Delhi meeting, Robin, because I think your question is a great one. And I personally, and again, I try not, you know, I don't think anything that I personally believe necessarily matters, but I personally do not like the notion of a one-size-fits-all. I think we heard quite directly during the XXX deliberations, at least that I was a part of when I was on the board, that, you know, different parts of the world, and any of us who have traveled know that different parts of the world feel differently. And I'm sure many people think that everyone in America is immoral and contrary to public order. And you know, conversely, I don't feel comfortable with sort of a bunch of people, and I don't even know who these people would be in some sense, figuring out what is quote-unquote immoral. There's a famous case in American jurisprudence where some judge basically said, you know, I don't know what pornographic, I can't define what that is, but I'll know it when I see it. You know, that kind of a standard always makes me a little bit uncomfortable to impose different things. I mean, you know, I don't wear a burqa, but some people do, and it's important to respect both of the ideals and ideologies. So I don't really love that. That's always been one of the recommendations in the GNSO new TLD report that's bothered me. And just so you all know, I had a discussion with John Jeffrey during the Delhi meetings where he, because it's been something that's kind of one of my personal issues, and I asked him sort of how was staff coming, because, you know, the board had asked staff to kind of get the implementation report to the board by January, and we're still kind of waiting and waiting eagerly to hear that so we can start acting. And apparently, staff hired a bunch of different law firms around the world to kind of try to standardize that specific recommendation. And not surprisingly, it's tough. And I think that's going to be very difficult to execute. So my understanding, and again, this is informal, and I know we all had problems with the, you know, on the GNSO meeting dialing in, but I was driving me nuts, and any all the board committees and the board, you know, I was getting up at 3, 4 in the morning and getting dropped every 20 minutes because there were like 35 different phone wires and they were taking pictures and sending them to me. But it was very frustrating to be participating robustly. But I think this is one of the things, Robin, that you're going to hear from staff soon as to some of these implementation issues. I'm looking for some more guidance from the council as to what you all really thought about when you were recommending this.
Any follow-up, Robin?
Nope. That's helpful.
Anyone else?
What do you guys think about that? I'd love to hear, are you guys all in agreement with that, or is that kind of way out there?
I'll take a cue. Anybody want to comment? I'll jump in, Rita. You know, I think we knew with this recommendation, as well as with a couple others, that we were giving staff a huge and very challenging task with regard to implementation. Obviously, we had some competing views within the GNSO and within the community at large with regard to this type of issue. And I think we're all going to be very interested in seeing what the final recommendations with regard to implementation on this one, as well as a few others, come back as, and whether it's possible to do something in this area or nothing or what. It's going to be quite interesting to see. But and Rita, you weren't able to participate in the Saturday session when Kurt gave us the overview of the implementation process. But at the end, I told him I was very impressed with the caliber of work they had done and were still doing with regard to all this. And so I am quite confident that they're doing a very thorough job. Now, whether they can come back with ways to implement all of our recommendations remains to be seen, but that's what we've asked them to tell us. And then we'll have to go back and maybe on some of them and regroup.
Thanks.
Okay.
Yep.
All right, Robin, how about question number 8?
Okay, this one has to do with ICANN and human rights. So could ICANN build more protections for human rights into its governance structure by incorporating guarantees found in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, for example, into its corporate bylaws? Basically, my question is, how can we ensure protection for fundamental values in an entity that is a legal corporation?
So I guess help me understand what you're specifically referring to, that it's kind of within the basic human rights of people to get so many means. I'm trying to kind of apply this to ICANN in general.
Well, I think the fact that ICANN is sort of fulfilling a quasi-governmental, certainly a policy role here, means the same kinds of basic values that we expect from governments or legal institutions, we should also expect from ICANN. And so how do we try to make sure that ICANN is fair and that ICANN makes sure that basic human rights, when they are actually invoked, are respected in the processes.
For
example, freedom of speech, privacy rights, a lot of times the policies that we deal with impact both of those issues. So my question is, how do we make sure that we're able to continue to protect privacy rights, we're able to continue to protect freedom of expression rights? In a place that is a corporation and ultimately governed by corporate bylaws and state statutory rules about corporations, how do we build in those other kinds of protections into this kind of a structure, a governance structure?
Well, I think that, I remember attending a conference years ago where people were talking about free speech and how important free speech is within the ICANN structure, and someone from the audience said, well, free speech is actually a very distinctly American idea, and you don't even recognize the concept in our country. And I've always thought of that since there, because I do think that to some extent those of us that come from an American background do try to impose very distinctly American ideals on everything within ICANN. But I think, Robin, that if you look at free speech and privacy, those two are issues that are quite vigorously discussed within the ICANN community. I'm not sure that you build into a charter those types of views. I'm not sure that that's necessarily appropriate or needed, because then I'm sure there'd be a laundry list of other things people would want to do. But I do think that the work that certainly your constituency does and others do, I think is what needs to continue to be done. And I think that the outreach that I'm at least hoping happens with some of the at-large and non-commercial is going to continue. I think you're seeing, I think, frankly, I'm very encouraged by what's happening with at-large and getting more representation of individual users on a really sort of substantial and robust level, and I think that's the effective way to do it. We could certainly, ruminate on how we can best build it into a charter, but frankly, I think that the better bang for the buck is real robust individual participation and making sure that these issues stay at the forefront of debate.
And if I can jump in there, Robin, and you're welcome to respond. I think we have to keep ICANN's mission in view in a lot of this. Now, clearly, with regard to privacy, for example, that has come into play with regard to who is, and seems to be a very appropriate way for it to come in for. But an awful lot of the human rights issues that you're talking about come into play more, not necessarily exclusively, with content on the Internet than it does with the parameters that ICANN coordinates in its role. again, understanding that even selection of a TLD string, you know, can be some sort of an expression there. So don't you think that we have to, in dealing with this, ICANN's mission is really relatively limited. And how much of it really does relate to human rights because they don't get into the content area, if you accept that assumption? Any other comments on that? Okay. The next question comes from Tim Ruiz, who couldn't join us on this call. And the first one he asks is, the ICANN staff recently submitted to the Council a synthesis on single-character names at the second level. One of the auction methods that state is having been suggested is managed or qualified auction for those with prior rights. While the synthesis only makes this single mention of prior rights, it is likely to become a much bigger issue. What is your view or position regarding prior rights claims to single-character names at the second level?
I haven't seen the report or talked to anybody about this. I'm assuming what they're talking about is that's kind of a shout-out, if you will, to the issue that's already, you know, been around forever, which is trademark owners saying that they have some sort of a pre-existing right to the names. And so I'm assuming what they're talking about is there'll be an auction, but the extent to which maybe there's going to be some sort of a sunrise, or if people have a trademark registration for a single letter, trademark, they'll be able to come forward, but I have no idea what this is really, in fact, referring to.
I just looked at this report, actually, in the last half hour before this meeting started, and even had a little chat with Patrick Jones, who wrote the report. It's important for us, first of all, to understand that that is just a synthesis of the ideas that were put forward by people that commented during the public comment period. It's very important for us to recognize that ICANN staff is not recommending anything specific be done with regard to prior rights, but that was one idea that was put forward in the comment period, and so it was included in the synthesis. And more work's going to be done on this. So I'm sure, and this is a particular area, those of you that are familiar with some of the work that was proposed by Overstock probably 2 years ago at least now, when they put forward some ideas, and one of their suggestions was that there should be preference for those who have some rights in a single letter name above others. And comments in the public comment period also said, and this is in the synthesis, there were those who thought anybody should have a chance to get a single letter name, whether they have intellectual property rights or not. So these are issues that we're, I'm sure, going to grapple with as we grapple with this particular issue of allocation of single character names.
And Chuck, I guess if I could just jump in here, you know, my view on that is everyone can certainly have a view on, you know, I think that there should be anybody that should be able to apply. But the reality is that if somebody has a trademark right, and we saw that before the UDLP existed, which is why we made the UDLP, I guess, to some extent, there may be courts that will, even if we did open it up to everyone and somebody got a single letter domain, but a court felt that somebody had prior rights to it, they would have to give it up. So again, I think this is the kind of thing where while theoretical debates may be fun and interesting for people to have, I think sometimes in all of ICANN issues, we do need to kind of understand what the legal framework is and be realistic and practical about what restrictions may exist.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments on that question? Okay, going to question number 10, also from Tim. There's likely to be ongoing policy work regarding the allocation of IDN CCTLDs. Any resultant policy will have a significant impact on both the GTLD and CCTLD communities. In your view, is this an example of a need for a cross-SO policy development process? And the second question, in your view, is a cross-SO process reasonable to consider given the evolving nature of the Internet?
So my answer to, is this an example of a need for a cross-SO policy development process, a resounding, absolutely, in my view, yes, 100%. please have at it. I'm not quite sure I got the last, is a cross-SO process reasonable given the evolving nature of the Internet? I think the Internet is evolving and becoming more global, as is the general world. So I didn't understand that last part of this question, but yes, I think that absolutely this you know, again, this new fast-track IDN working group with GeniusO representation, I think I've said this on the record in L.A. as well, that I think the extent to which you can all talk about, get out issues on the table, try to understand where each other's coming from, that's going to go a long way into getting some sort of policy that can be easily implemented.
And I don't know that I can translate Tim's second question any better. Anybody else have a thought, maybe, what he's getting at there? Now, possibly, I have no idea whether this is what Tim's getting at or not, but maybe the question could be asked, is it really realistic, considering that the CCNSO has its own PDP and the GNSO has its own, and they're not necessarily identical, and obviously they're working in very different environments, is it really realistic to consider some sort of a cross-SO PDP? And I have no idea whether that's what he's getting at.
Yeah, and I think you guys are probably in a better position to answer that based on your interaction. But, again, maybe I'm too idealistic, but I like to think if people are working towards a common goal, even if they come to the table with different points of view, they can manage to at least try to understand each other and try to compromise.
Okay. Anybody else have a thought on that?
The way I read the question was the second one was asked if the answer to the first one was no. In other words, if a cross-SO policy development process is not appropriate for this particular case, is it something we should be considering in general?
Okay. Thanks, Alan.
I go yes with both. So the answer to one is yes, definitely this particular issue, and I would love to see more cross-supporting organization policies and interaction.
I think the following question is, does that mean we need bylaw changes, or does that simply mean that we need supporting organizations which cooperate with each other and play nice?
Alan, you know my view on that, right? We're all big kids in the playpen. So I'd like to think we won't have to regulate to do that, but you know, I leave that to you guys.
Okay. Number 11 comes from Norbert, and hopefully each of you, this was one of the last things that came in, had a chance to read the background that Norbert gave. It was fairly lengthy. I did include it down below on the document I sent out. And it's a background that I think most of us are familiar with anyway, but it is there for your reference. And then what I did is I tried to pull out from there two questions that Norbert raised. He says, I would appreciate getting some comments regarding what you think should be done on the ICANN board level about the issue of travel cost support for GNSO council members with your active initiative, I would hope. And then the second one is, I also would appreciate to know how you would assist ICANN use its travel resources more wisely. Maybe we ought to take one of those at a time. Taking the first one about what you think, Rita, should be done on the board level with regard to the travel costs of GNSO council members.
My view is again, when I found out actually that council members were not supported in terms of, at a minimum, travel to board meetings, and I guess Chuck, you wrote, I think, a little bit of a clarification there. So council members are supported in some specific travel, but not to ICANN general meetings, is
right.
That
right? Right, except the first time it happened to an ICANN general meeting was in Delhi that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I mean, my view on that is pretty unabashedly, I don't understand. So I need to understand why we haven't instituted a method for council members to fly to meetings. I think certainly things can be done with the Internet, with chat, with teleconferences, and I think you all have done an amazing job of doing significant work remotely, but everyone knows that face-to-face time is really important. I think if we look at the GNSO as the way that council, that policy is made in this space, I don't understand how we don't then support financially and otherwise you guys coming to meetings. I know that there's been discussions and acceptance of this notion of having better staff support for you all, getting additional resources, teleconferencing, et cetera. And I hope there's been, at least in your view, some progress made there. But I think this last piece of funding you all to attend meetings is absolutely critical, and I am 1,000% in support of it. And frankly, puzzled as to why it hasn't been done already.
The question came up in New Delhi that probably you weren't able to hear because of the technical problems. But in the discussion, the workshop that occurred on this, a member of the business constituency raised the issue of the fact that most, if not all, counselors are actually, and I don't think the term lobbyist was used, but basically lobbying for particular viewpoints that either their constituency or them personally are interested in. How do you balance the idea? I mean, you have the idea that most of the overwhelming majority of ICANN financial resources come from registrants. And so... Come from registrants.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the fees
yep.
that are paid through registries and registrars. And so is it right to have registrants basically paying these fees for particular interest groups being able to, lobby for their points of view through the policy development process? That question was raised in the discussion there, and probably one that you weren't able to hear. What do you think about that? I thought it was an interesting point that's raised. How do you balance the need to encourage participation and facilitate it, even on a cost point of view, with this idea that obviously people are really there representing particular viewpoints and maybe even lobbying for the interests of those entities?
Well, again, I had not heard that, so thanks for that, Chuck. And again, I think that you can kind of, frankly, twist anything to seem unfair. Everything that ICANN does and all of the fees that are paid for ICANN are coming out of essentially what the registrants are paying, right? The whole budget. So we're supporting staff flying, looking for venues, and people flying to different countries to further different agendas, as well as board members. I think that's certainly an interesting, again, sort of cerebral intellectual question. I think that, again, if we look at the GNSO as a critical piece of ICANN, and the way that ICANN policy is going to get developed is by having different constituencies with different points of view come to the table, discuss them, advocate them, and then this is always, again, what I think is important, is to try to compromise to come up with a final position. That's what ICANN is supposed to do and how it's supposed to work, and therefore, in my view, that should be funded out of the budget.
And then another item that was discussed there was, okay, if we look at GNSO improvements and the recommendation to the working group model, where working groups become even more important, then does the same thinking apply to working group participation when in-person meetings are needed?
I think that's a great question. I have not really thought about that. I think we could certainly talk to Doug and others who are kind of more in the budget issues, but I would love to start taking small baby steps first and see how that works out. It's just, again, my gut reaction to that.
Anybody else want to comment on that first question from Norbert before we go to his second question? His second question relates to what he observed in terms of the funding for the Delhi meetings was, you know, not good cost efficiency in terms of the airline rates and so forth that were obtained. And so his question with that context was, I also would appreciate to know how you would assist ICANN use its travel resources more wisely.
I think that's a great question as well. You know, I'll tell you all that I was not that pleased with how things panned out at Delhi on a number of levels, and the budget overruns were just, in my view, inexcusable. And at one point, I sent an email to somebody saying, I can't believe that $61 million can't get me into, you know, a board call. I think it's, you know, it's the second meeting that I participated in remotely, and I am underwhelmed, to say the least, at the capabilities that we have. And Now, one of the things that I think is an issue for me at least is sometimes within you have to appreciate all the hard work that everybody in ICANN does, from staff staff and management side to the board to all of you that spend money, spend your time, fly around the world to help make this process work, and I think it's great. But I also think that there's a real need now to kind of step it up, and I think we need to have there's things that should really be kind of on autopilot, and they're not, and I don't really understand why that is. But I'd like to see a travel policy that makes sense for everyone, and that is really basically a plug and play. And I think that is something that hopefully can happen sooner than later. But I think this kind of acceptable if this kind of I'm okay with mediocrity in some of these areas is just not cutting the race for me anymore. And I'd really like to see some improvements in a lot of the travel and remote participation capabilities.
And in fairness to Doug Brent, he did communicate even before New Delhi, but again in New Delhi, that the goal is to develop a comprehensive travel policy. So apparently work is going on that.
Yeah, absolutely. This is not a new issue for the board. Board members have definitely been talking about this for a while, and I think that Doug and his team are working very diligently to do this. And I know that Paul Levins and I had a discussion about the Delhi overruns, and they were unavoidable. And there's absolutely things that are going to happen, particularly given the places that these meetings are held. There's always, and if you look at what's going on in Kenya now, unfortunately, it's who could have foreseen that? And now people are scrambling once again to figure out what we're going to do. So there's definitely variables and things that are going to come up, and that's why I think it's even more important to have some sort of a general plug and play that should be able to run as smoothly as possible and free up people to deal with some of these other one-off things that will invariably occur.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions on this? Okay, then we go to question number 12, which is again from Adrian. He says that I would like to see a regular monthly report from our representative on board issues and where she stands on them, potentially with time allotted on calls and in meetings. And then I added the question associated with that: is that possible, and are you willing to do that?
I wasn't sure if Adrian wanted me to write a book report to him every month or what. certainly I've tried my best to be on the call, and as most of you know, I'm not really shy when Denise Michelle is giving her kind of statements to kind of chime in. I think certainly that is something that I'd like to continue doing, and that I'm sure Bruce would like to continue to do. I'm not sure if he's talking about a regular monthly written report, which I think, given a lot of my other commitments, would be a little bit much unless people really think that's something that is necessary. Bruce and I can certainly discuss that, but I wasn't sure what he's looking for his talk other than.
Okay. Do some of the rest of you have thoughts in that regard? Okay. Well, we'll just encourage Adrian to clarify his position to you and on the council list so that to make sure he gets it answered there. His next question was, and the last one of the advanced questions is, I would like to see a representative present at our council days at ICANN meetings where board commitments permit.
I think that was present.
What did I say?
You said present.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Thank you, Alan. I appreciate that. In other words, he's asking, he's saying that he'd like to have you and Bruce at our, I'm assuming he needs the GNSO open council meeting that we usually have on Wednesdays, assuming the days stay the same in the meetings. And maybe even present at those meetings. So is that something that's possible, and how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, and I think Bruce and I try as much as we can to be there. We have, I think that usually happens on, if I was assuming he's talking about the Wednesday meeting too, Chuck, and that usually happens on our all-favorite constituency day?
No, it happens on the next day.
Oh, it does? Okay.
Yeah.
Because I know that sometimes we have other things that we don't control our schedule, and and four board committees now, and then with this GNSO improvements, it's kind of busy.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't control our schedule. Diane kind of gives us a printout of where we're supposed to be at what time. But I know that personally, you know, the board is now, as you all know, trying different formats with Constituency Day. And I think most board members like the notion of kind of traveling to different constituencies and getting a broad cross-section of what people are concerned with. I'm kind of torn on that because I would like to be able to be present at GNSO meetings. I think that's, we're talking about communication and having more effective understanding between the GNSO and Bruce and I think we kind of need to be present at those meetings. So I'm definitely in support of that. And I think the question just is trying to figure out where the rest of the board stands. I know that some board members want to have people more rotating in and out of different things. But I certainly, to the extent to which my schedule permits, always try to be at the council meetings.
Okay. Any follow-up questions or discussion on that? Okay. We've now come to the point where I'll open it up for any new questions that anybody wants to raise or even comments. And Rita, you're welcome to participate in that as well. Okay, and by the way, I want to welcome Christina and Jordy to the call. Sorry you couldn't be with us on the whole call. We're just coming to the end right now, and Christina and Jordy, if you have a question you'd like to ask, even if it relates to one of the topics we already discussed, we'll let you know if it's too much repeating, but feel free to bring that up now.
Thank you, Chuck. That's okay on my side.
Okay.
I'm following and reading. Thanks.
Thanks, Jordy.
Rita, this is Christina. The only question I have, and again, I was caught in a call, so I apologize for joining late, is there's been a lot of talk in a lot of quarters about trying to make attendance at the meetings easier for everyone, not only the counselors, but also members of constituencies, members of the advisory committees, et cetera. And that in connection with that, one idea that seems to be getting a lot of traction, at least I keep hearing about it from different people, is the idea of selecting within each of the various regions one or two cities to act as meeting hubs, with the idea being that these are the two cities in this region that the meetings will be held at. You will know that when it's every other meeting in this region will be at the city, so you can plan accordingly. We'll have, over time, enough of a relationship with the prominent hotel that we can negotiate good rates, et cetera. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that whole idea of hub cities.
It's one of those things, Christina, where sometimes I feel like I'm in, ICAM La La Land, because Susan Crawford, as you all know, was chairing the meetings committee and did a lot of work over the past, at least my tenure on the board, and had this idea of hub cities. And apparently, the meetings committee was just dissolved, I think, at the last BGC meeting, and kind of nothing came out of that. And what we were told was that there wasn't really traction for that. So it's marginally amusing, but not really, to me that now you're saying that's getting more traction, because I'm not sure why that got killed in the first place. But be that as it may, I certainly am in favor of making attendance easier. My understanding of why hub cities wasn't something that people thought was a good thing was that by having ICANN travel to different cities, it allowed a broader participation of folks that couldn't, in fact, travel. So if we are just selecting three cities or so, that really then isolates many of other potential participants that would want to come to these meetings. So when we're in, Santiago, Chile, or Wellington, or Ghana, or, wherever, it's allowing some of those local participants who really can't fly anywhere to come and participate and learn a little bit what ICANN is about. So I sort of see both sides of it. I don't know if you were on for the part of the call about, funding GNSO council member travel. I think it's kind of I see both sides. And again, I'm somewhat dismayed because I thought that Susan had put this idea of hubs out there and the community didn't like it. So I don't know what to tell you on that, really. I think everyone's certainly open to making attendance easier and more robust, but also balancing the notion of trying to, you know, be as inclusive and get to different parts of the world as much as we can.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, Rita, it's interesting because I certainly am very familiar with what Susan was advocating there, and she did it in some, you know, of the public ICANN meetings a ways back. But I never really did hear opposition to that idea, so maybe I just missed it. And I think the idea was to have a, well, if you had three meetings a year, you have a couple at hub cities, and you still allow for at least one meeting a year to be at a non-hub city to facilitate the other thing. But anyway, I'll be curious if you ever get any information with regard to how that opposition was determined. I certainly wasn't privy to the opposition to that idea. I do understand that the interest in getting allowing easier involvement for people in remote areas where they probably wouldn't be able to come, even to a hub city, and I think that's legitimate. But I think, as I recall, Susan's one of the ideas was to kind of balance the two so that you have some improvement. So if you get any insight in that as to how they determined that there was a lot of opposition to that, I'd be curious.
Okay, I will do.
Anyone else have a question or a comment before we adjourn this meeting? Okay. Well, again, Rita, thank you very much for the time you devoted to this. I think it's been very informative, and hopefully we'll have more of these in the future. And not just wait for election time. And also thanks to each of you that participated on the call, as well as those of you that submitted questions in advance. And now it's for the rest of the council who couldn't attend to listen to the recording. Thanks a lot, and have a good rest of the day.
Yeah, thanks everyone. For my part, I'm really encouraged, and I really appreciate everybody submitting questions and participating in the call. It's great for me, again, to hear what's on your minds, and I would second Chuck's notion that I hope we can actually do this more often, and we'll hopefully be able to think of ways to actually execute on that. Again, I think sometimes we have great ideas, and then we never, you know, move the next step and figure out how we're going to do those, but I'm certainly open to having more calls with you all with Bruce, so that we can actually really understand what's on your mind and try to help as best we can.
Okay, thanks everybody. Meeting adjourned.
Bye.
Goodbye.